I think these are political issues, and we should use a political vocabulary in order to try to understand them. It's not Oprah.
It's not what?
Oprah.
Oprah, right.
It's politics. So I prefer to use the political categories to try to understand it and to look at other historical analogies which enable us to better understand what's happening.
Yeah. And what's happening is really put forward in your book. It's a description, both a comparison in which you position yourself towards the case of Israel by Dershowitz. It's a political analysis. But the title of your book reads Beyond Chutzpah. And everyone I know says, what's chutzpah? Is it some kind of delicacy? Is it dessert?
No.
Is it a dish?
No, it's a Yiddish word. Yiddish is a corruption of German. It's a Yiddish word. And usually it has two meanings. You never know whether it's an insult or a compliment when somebody says you have chutzpah. It's a borderline word because it both means that you're bold and you're aggressive, and it means you're obnoxious.
Right.
So it's a word, it has a double entendre. It could be good and it could be bad.
Yeah, it's a bit like, wow, you got guts.
Yeah.
Guts. Yeah. And why is it beyond chutzpah?
Professor Dershowitz, who I focus on in the book, he wrote an autobiography which was called Chutzpah, and I was making a play on his autobiography and saying, this is beyond chutzpah because it's sheer lies. It's complete fraud. And it's the peculiarity of American culture on this particular topic that the fraud is taken seriously. And now we can speak a year after the book came out in the United States, and it makes no difference. You can write a whole book showing every word he writes is a lie. It does no damage to his reputation at all. Nothing. The book didn't receive, my book, didn't receive a single mainstream review in the United States. Completely ignored. Dershowitz is still quoted everywhere. He appears in all the radio shows, television programs. No effect at all.
You know, it's a new Bible, the new Talmud.
You know, when you have power on your side, facts have no impact at all. It's meaningless.
Yeah. Yesterday I interviewed Loreto Napoleoni, and she wrote two books on Iraq and especially terrorism, how it's organized in Iraq. And she also says similar things. Basically, it's a huge system of a machinery that produces lies, that produces propaganda, that manipulates figures, statistics, that manipulates basically the reality. But then they just can get away with it. And it's one of these amazing things when you read your book that you go, how could it possibly be true that they just can get away with it? I mean, it's about people being tortured, being liquidated politically, killed, and so on. Houses being bulldozed. How can people just get away with it? It's amazing. And that's what you're saying.
What's amazing for me is I'm the one who's called controversial. Whereas what I'm saying is not controversial at all. If you look at the book, all of the references are to very mainstream organizations. It's Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Israeli human rights organizations. This is not controversial. And yet I'm the one who's labeled controversial. Yesterday I was interviewed by very nice students at the hotel where I'm staying. And one of the students talks to me or asks me about my controversial book on Goldhagen. I said, there's nothing controversial in my book. I don't read German archives. I just looked at what mainstream German historians have written. And I said, Goldhagen's book is nonsense. I'm just telling you what the mainstream says. And it's the same thing here. It's one of the marvels of American culture that the lunatic becomes mainstream, mm-hmm. and the mainstream becomes controversial.
Yeah, it looks a bit like a pattern, especially in Israel, especially in America right now.
On political issues, yeah. It's a pattern.
Yeah.
Because the United States is completely out of the mainstream. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at United Nations votes on everything from the ozone layer to the law of the sea, mm-hmm. and everything in between, the United States is completely out of the mainstream.
Yeah.
But they think they're in the mainstream, mm-hmm. and the rest of the world is crazy.
Yeah.
Or usually they think the rest of the world is jealous. Mm-hmm. It's envious. So in that respect, the Americans and the Israelis have come to resemble each other a lot.
Yeah.
Namely, they think that all of the resentment has nothing to do with what they have done, with how they have acted. All the resentment comes from envy and jealousy, mm-hmm. because we're so beautiful. And that's both the Israelis and the Americans.
Yeah. But while they're in the Luna Bin, they're also extremely out of touch with reality, no?
I think it's probably half and half. Mm-hmm. Because you cannot be a power of that magnitude, like the United States, and to be completely out of touch with reality. That's not really possible. On the other hand, when you have so much power, mm-hmm. you can afford to be a little bit out of touch with reality, because any of the mistakes you make, you can just drop a few more bombs. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to be exactly in touch with reality, because you can compensate for your errors with sheer physical, sheer physical force. Mm-hmm. That's why when you're on the weaker side, you have to be very clever, mm-hmm. because you do not have physical force to compensate for your errors.
Yeah.
And therefore, you have to be much sharper. Mm-hmm. That's why now Hezbollah has the brains and Israel has the brawn, mm-hmm. because Israel had so much physical power, it stopped thinking. It always imagined whatever mistake we make, we can just saturate them with more bombs. When you're weak, you don't have those extra bombs, so you have to think. Mm-hmm. Being weak makes you think more.
Yeah. Are you not afraid of being bombed yourself?
Excuse me?
Are you not afraid being bombed yourself?
I
suppose
you.
You're being bombed by hate mail.
I'll tell you the truth. When I was speaking today at the book fair,
yeah.
I was not pleased that the lights were dimmed. I'm serious.
I can imagine. Yeah.
I'm serious.
I can really believe that. Yeah. Because last week in Russia, Anna Politkovskaya got killed, got shot. She mm-hmm. was a journalist. She was stating figures about mm-hmm. torture,
that was probably,
giant abuse of human rights.
That was probably government-sponsored.
Yeah, indeed.
I'm more afraid of the lone crazies.
And the Lone Rangers.
Yeah, and the Lone Rangers, right.
Right, yeah. Now, going further on your title, you say on the misuse of anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you have to expand a bit on this for the listener, because anti-Semitism means that you say, there's a Jew, let's mm-hmm. discriminate uh-huh. against the Jew.
No? Yeah, I think, you know, there is anti-Semitism as it used to be understood mm-hmm. meant an irrational hatred of Jews. You just hate Jews because they're Jewish. Mm-hmm. So if you have a rational reason for hating Jews, you wouldn't really be called an anti-Semite. Let's take a simple example. You live in a refugee camp in Lebanon, and every other week its plane flies over your camp, drops bombs, and the plane has a Star of David on it. It's an Israeli plane. If from that experience you conclude that Jews are nasty people, I would not call you an anti-Semite. Mm-hmm. That's a rational conclusion based on rational experience. Maybe you should not have generalized, but given that your only experience with Jews is these Jewish planes flying over and dropping bombs, I personally would not call it anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. So that kind of dislike of Jews, I don't think should be called anti-Semitism. It used to be said, you know, that the Nazi anti-Semitism, it was irrational. And that's what typified the Nazi anti-Semitism. Now, in the world today, in the Western world today, the amount of the old-fashioned anti-Semitism, the irrational kind, it's so minimum. It's not serious. In the United States today, you know, you have maybe a little a fringe group, or in Europe, you have a right-wing fringe which is anti-Semitic, and you have, you know, some Muslim youth anti-Semitic. Apart from that, it's simply not an issue anymore. It's not a significant social issue. What do I mean by that? If you're denied jobs because you're Jewish, it's a problem. If you're denied housing because you're Jewish, it's a problem. If you're denied access to education because you're Jewish, it's a problem. Of course, if you're physically attacked because you're Jewish, it's a problem. Mm-hmm. But if people have these feelings about Jews that they walk around with, to my thinking, it's just not a significant problem in the world today. Anyone knows in society, short people, they have a problem. You know, it's not easy to be short. It's not easy to be fat. It's not. Really? You know, people have prejudices against fat people. It's not easy to be ugly. It's a fact. You know, in our society, being ugly is a real disability. So all of these are, in my opinion, the equivalent of now what Jews face. The equivalent of being short, fat, or ugly. It's not a big social problem. Mm-hmm. And to claim that there is a rise of anti-Semitism in Western Europe or in the United States of the old variety is simply a fraud.
It's a demagoguery.
It's complete demagoguery. There's no evidence for it. Mm-hmm. They say Human Rights Watch, anti-Semitic, Amnesty International. You may be laughing, but I mean it's literally. During the summer, when Human Rights Watch came out with its report stating that Israel committed war crimes in Lebanon, all the Jewish organizations, Professor Dershowitz, all of them, start to say Human Rights Watch is anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. The head of Human Rights Watch, his name is Ken Roth. He's Jewish. His parents are refugees from Nazi Germany. Anti-Semitic. Everyone is anti-Semitic who criticizes Israel. That's not serious. That's what you correctly called it's demagoguery. It's politically useful demagoguery.
Yeah. Yeah.
To discredit anyone who criticizes Israel,
yeah,
as being an anti-Semite. But in the real world, it's trivial. You know, most Jews have, in the United States, basically the same situation as me. My family, economically, I had no deprivations. Mm-hmm. Good schools, good jobs. Nobody ever denied me a position because I'm Jewish. They have denied me positions because of my views on Israel and the Nazi Holocaust, but not because I'm Jewish. How many people in Belgium are denied access to a university because they're Jewish?
No one.
Denied access to a law firm because they're Jewish. Denied access to a hospital because they're Jewish. It's silly. Mm-hmm. This is all just fabricated.
Yeah, but the other thing that you write in your book is that there is this constant mingling of the Israel nation or state and, mm-hmm, Jewish people. And if you say something about, or if you criticize the nation, mm-hmm, because of their policy, then immediately they say, well, now you're offending the Jews.
Right.
And this is, I find, the most, the most worrying things. You cannot criticize a nation for its policy anymore, because immediately they say, look, you're referring now to the Jews and the Jews are wrong. And this is really like a huge confusion that's being played out, also in a very demagogic way. But it's a good tactic to also, and that's another statement in your book, to immunize yourself against any form of criticism.
Right, and it works in just the reverse way also. Namely, Israel says it's the state of the Jewish people. The Jewish organizations say that Israel speaks for them. And then, when Arabs take them at their word and don't like any Jews because of what Israel says, they all react in shock. Why are you attacking Jews because of what Israel has done? It's because you're an anti-Semite. But you were the one who said there's no difference between Israel and the Jews. So then how can you pretend to be surprised when people take you at your word and they attack Jews? Well, you said you're their state. But they want to have it both ways. They want to claim that you are attacking Israel because you're an anti-Semite. And they also want to claim that if you attack Jews because of Israel, you're an anti-Semite. But you said that Israel represents the Jews. If the Jewish organizations went around saying Israel does not represent Jews, and if Israel said, we only represent the Israeli people, then I can see an argument. Why do Arabs dislike Jews? We have nothing to do with it. But if you're saying you represent Jews, and the Jewish organizations say you represent Jews, then it's totally irrational.
Yeah. And this is also one of your focuses in your book, that you basically analyze arguments, how people argue. Yeah.
I often like to do that.
Yeah, and often you find that...
Because most of the arguments make no sense.
Indeed, yeah.
Most people, I've come to the conclusion that most people do not read a book looking for a coherent argument. Whatever it says on page one, they believe what's on page one. And on page three, if what they see on page three completely contradicts what they read on page one, most people don't care. Page three is true, and page one is true. I really believe that, because the more I read, the more I see that books are filled with so many blatant contradictions that anybody attentive to the words and concerned about a coherent, rational argument has to see that page four contradicts what I just read on page two. But most people don't see it.
Yeah.
I find that so odd. That was with the Goldhagen book, The Hitler's Willing Executioners. It was filled with the most incredible nonsense, not in terms of quoting sources incorrectly, but in terms of page 5 does not make sense after what he said on page 2. And I do believe most people don't care. I don't quite know why.
Yeah, it's funny.
It doesn't make sense to me. But I whenever I read, I do have, like, I guess I have a good memory for what I read 3 pages before. Because immediately I stop and say, well, wait. He said on page 6, and and I write in the margin, you know, see page 6. And I don't quite understand. Now it's perplexing me. Because right now I'm writing something on Israel's leading authority in international law. Very smart guy, Yoram Dinstein. He's the president of Tel Aviv University. And he's written these very sophisticated books on the laws of war and human rights law. And the books are very impressive as legal inquiries, but they're also filled with apologetics for Israel. And it's just very striking to me. He's constantly contradicting himself. Mm-hmm. And I wonder to myself, why don't people see this?
Yeah.
It's put out by the best publishers, and it's the most respected books in the world on the topic. But it's obvious this is nonsense. This is nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a matter of real perplexity to me.
Yeah.
Why don't people see it?
Because if you analyze the arguments, one of the most frequent one is the argument ad hominem.
Uh-huh.
Like, right, you saying that Israel is wrong, and I'm saying that you are a wrong person because you're anti-Semite. That's one. And then the other one is what they call in Latin, if you study a bit about how arguments are built, they call it petitio principi, saying like, what I'm saying is what I'm saying, but I'm not going to put forward any evidence, but what I'm saying is what I'm saying.
Right.
And it's one of those two striking things in your book, that these two arguments are very often used by Israel.
Well, yesterday, just to give you an example on the second point you made,
mm-hmm.
There's now, as I said a moment ago, after the Human Rights Watch report came out on Lebanon, all of the human rights organizations are being attacked as being anti-Semitic. So there's this fellow now in Canada. He was before at Harvard. His name is Michael Ignatieff. So Michael Ignatieff was the head of human rights at Harvard. Now he wants to be the Prime Minister of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
During the war in Lebanon, Israel bombed the village of Qana, killed 28 people. You may recall in the basement they were taking shelter. Human rights, so at the time, Michael Ignatieff, he was asked about it. He said, quote, I did not lose any sleep over what happened at Qana, because he wants the Jewish money. The Jews are quite powerful in Canada. He needs the Jewish money for his candidacy, to pay for his election. Then, last week, he was being attacked a lot about what he said about Qana. So he said, well, I read the Human Rights Watch reports. I read Amnesty's report. I read Human Rights Watch reports. He said, I've changed my mind. It was a war crime.
Mm.
Well, now, all hell broke loose. I'm serious. It's a hysteria now in Canada, because he called it a war crime. So the former Minister of Justice, a guy named Erwin Kotler, he's very powerful. His wife, Ariella Kotler, she said, I am ripping up my Liberal Party membership card because of what Ignatieff said.
Mm-hmm.
Then, yesterday, Alan Dershowitz writes a long column in the main Canadian newspaper. And he says, quote, it is indisputable that Hezbollah terrorists were in the Qana village when Israel bombed it.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, everybody has seen the videotape. It's indisputable. Now, the fact of the matter is, it's indisputable there were no Hezbollah militants anywhere near that village for 2 days. It makes no difference. He just comes along and says, the evidence is indisputable.
Mm-hmm.
Makes no difference.
Yeah.
That's how these people work. He knows it's a lie. He's not stupid. Don't fool yourself. You don't become the senior professor in Harvard Law School by being an idiot. No, he's not stupid. But he knows you can say anything.
Yeah.
Anything. And it won't make a difference.
Yeah. And this is one of the most terrible things right now, I find, because it makes people extremely angry. And at the same time, I also feel that it makes you finally sick in a way, but you don't show. You're very good at hiding it.
I laugh.
Yeah?
That's the only thing I could do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most of the time on my website, I ridicule these people with humor.
Mm-hmm.
I make fun of them. You know, I say funny, nasty things. And then sometimes people say, oh, it's not dignified, you shouldn't say that, you know. If I don't laugh, I'll explode. They spend all their time now calling me, the big thing is calling me a Holocaust denier.
Mm-hmm. And negationist.
Excuse me?
Someone who negates.
Right. Yeah. You know, for me to be a Holocaust denier, for me to be one, I would have to be clinically insane. No, that's not a joke. I would have to be. My mother was in that Majdanek concentration camp. My father was in Auschwitz concentration camp. Every single member of my parents' family was exterminated during the war. For me to be a Holocaust denier, I'd have to be clinically insane. So that's what you're telling me. You're telling me I'm clinically insane. Otherwise, what you're saying is the most grotesque imaginable lie. Now, there are two ways of dealing with it. One is to go out of your mind. You know, if my parents were around today, and the things they're now saying about my parents, they're saying my late mother was a Nazi collaborator. I mean, you can't believe what they're doing. If my mother were around today, and if I didn't do anything, I'm talking about physically do something. Like, go to Professor Dershowitz and throttle. I'm serious. And throttle him. You cannot imagine. I mean, we can laugh. But you cannot imagine how my mother would have reacted if anyone said, after everything she went through, that you collaborated with the Nazis, that you were a capo, after everything she went through. So, I have two choices. Either I take the first bus down to Boston, because I don't drive. Take the first bus down to Boston, go into his office, and kill him. Or just laugh. And just turn the whole thing into a joke. I try to laugh.
I do. Keep on writing, of course.
What?
And keep on writing.
I keep writing, but I always like to have a lot of humor. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the time my editors spend half the time saying, that has to go out, that has to go out, that has to go out.
There's no humor in this book.
This one lost, well, this was one of my editors, Marin.
Right.
She's saying, yeah, there was very little humor.
She killed the humor.
No, she didn't kill the humor. The libel lawyers killed the humor.
Oh, right, yeah.
There were eight of them. Mm-hmm. And I used to call them the eight humorless libel lawyers.
Yeah.
Because they took everything out. Mm-hmm. On my website, you can't take it out.
Oh, right.
I'm in charge.
Yeah.
Though now they're going after my website.
Yeah.
You know, they're saying, look,
they're
what
bombing that one.
Well, they're monitoring it.
All right.
You know. But I have to laugh. Mm-hmm. I have to. Otherwise, I would go completely out of my mind. And sometimes, I'm telling you, it's very hard to laugh. It's very hard to laugh. Mm-hmm. You know, those are very serious things. And I know my late mother would not laugh. I am quite sure.
Do you feel you have other people who are supporting you?
I would say in academic life, very few. Mm-hmm. In academic life, I would say, you know, speaking honestly, I would say Professor Chomsky was the only one over the past 20 years. Now there are a few more who are supporting me quietly, but in my opinion, for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
They're supporting me because they like the fact that I'm sticking it to the Jews. And they think that Jews are responsible for the disaster in Iraq. So there are people who are quite powerful who are now supporting me quietly. I don't particularly feel comfortable with that support because I think it's for the wrong reasons. They like me because I'm the only one who has the nerve, you know, to call these people what they are. I call them mafia. I call them Ku Klux Klan because they are, you know, and I say exactly what everybody else thinks.
They're the moral equivalent of the Ku Klux Klan.
They are the Ku Klux Klan. You know, maybe we're insulting the Klan a little here.
Oh, yeah.
But they are the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. So I get that kind of support. But the one who's really been there for me, you know, I would have to say, because it's factually true, it's been, you know, Professor Chomsky. You know, he was a big support.
Yeah.
Right now, I'm coming up for tenure. That basically means, I don't know if you have that system in Europe, the 10-year system.
No, I don't think so. At the university, no, we don't have that.
It basically means you, for 7 years, you're being monitored and observed.
All right.
And if you meet the basic criteria of being a professor, that is, you are a enough of a whore, then they give you a permanent position from which it's very hard to get rid of you.
Yeah.
So right now I'm coming up for tenure, and the forces of evil have been working very hard to deny me the tenure. Professor Dershowitz has been sending piles of stuff to my university, and not just him. Mm-hmm. It's all my enemies in the past 20 years.
It's a huge lobby. Huh?
You know, they're powerful. Mm-hmm. They're powerful. And they're now trying to stop me. And as it looks now, as of this moment, they're going to succeed. I was talking to a friend of mine, a German friend of mine, a mutual friend with my translator, and this morning, and she was saying, because they have to send a message. If you get in their way, they're going to destroy you. Mm-hmm. Because if you survive, then you transmit the message that you can attack them and still survive. So they have to transmit the message, if you attack us, we will destroy you. Mm-hmm. And so now they're out to destroy me. If I get tenure, it's a disaster, because it means Finkelstein with his mouth, he can still get a job, and you're not allowed to get a job, mm-hmm. you know? So
basically you're being gagged.
No, I think I'm being destroyed.
Being destroyed.
I don't
gagged
care.
And undestroyed.
I'm not worried though. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not worried because I'm, you know, tenure you're supposed to get in your 30s. Mm-hmm. Early 30s. So it's coming 20 years too late for me. Plus, I wanted tenure in New York where I lived, but they drove me out of New York. I was kicked out of every university where I taught in New York. I had to move to Chicago. So it's 20 years too late, and it's the wrong city. Mm-hmm. So I don't really care that much.
Still, it's the right person.
What?
It's still the right person.
It's still the right person. Yeah, and they'll get their amusement, because the university where I'm at now, it's not a top university. It's not even second. It's third. You could even say fourth. So they want to be able to say, you see this guy Finkelstein? He couldn't even get tenure at a fourth-rate university. Mm-hmm. He's such a loser.
Yeah.
That's what they want to be able to say. And, you know, they may get their satisfaction. They don't understand me. Mm-hmm. Because I was supposed to have failed. They blocked me from getting any regular job. They wouldn't review my books. They called me a nut. But I keep going. And they can't understand that. It's a complete enigma for them. Mm-hmm. Because they figure, I'm at Harvard. I go to all the right parties. I'm important. I have a mansion on Cape Cod. This guy Finkelstein lives in a room the size of my bathroom. Mm-hmm. Lives in the house, apartment the size of... So how comes he keeps going? They really can't understand it. And this guy Finkelstein, his books now, they're into 42 foreign translations. That's about 41 more than my books, they're thinking. No, they honestly don't understand it.
No, they
and
don't.
Then there was this guy, his name is Martin Peretz. He's the editor of a very influential American magazine called The New Republic, mm-hmm. right? And he only marries rich women. He married the heiress to the Hoover vacuum cleaner fortune.
Wow, cool.
Then he dumped her, and he married the heiress to the Singer sewing machine fortune, right? And he... No, I'm serious. And
that's quite a career move.
What?
That's quite a career move.
Yeah, I know. What's next? I'm not sure. But, Tetley tea or something. Yeah. In any case, he buys himself a position at Harvard. He buys himself a magazine. He buys himself the mansion in Cape, you know, in Cape Cod. And the other day, he's complaining, you know, Finkelstein, you Google his name, you get 700,000 hits. You Google Peretz, this guy Peretz, you get 294,000. Well, something's wrong.
It's not fair.
It's not fair. And they don't know how to stop me.
Yeah.
And it's not only they don't know how to stop me, they don't understand it. It's the same thing with Chomsky. Mm-hmm. They ignore him. They pretend he doesn't exist. They don't review his books. But it's like, it's an interesting phenomenon. It's the Chomsky tsunami. It builds and it builds and it builds. They denigrate him, they attack him, they ignore him, they say he's crazy, they say he's a Holocaust denier and everything. He keeps working, he keeps working, he keeps working. Turns out one book a year, two books a year, three books a year. Now he's published 105 books everywhere in the world. Everyone knows Noam Chomsky. When they asked to name the leading intellectual in the world, there was a poll in England. It's Chomsky first, and way, way behind him is Umberto Eco, you know? And then Chomsky is number one on Amazon. You know, last week he was number one. They can't understand it. Wait, we didn't review his books. He didn't come to our wine and cheese parties. He doesn't have a mansion in the Cape. How could he be number one? They can't understand that. They really can't. They're so intoxicated by their power. They cannot understand when little people manage through sheer hard work to accomplish what they can't even accomplish with all of their money, all of their wealth, all of their power.
Yeah. Maybe is it due to the fact that in Europe, both you and Chomsky are well received?
I wouldn't say I'm well received in Europe. I would say I'm...
I mean, right now, here.
I'm saying I'm...
Nice fountain.
I'm
nice tablecloth.
Nice speaker.
Yeah. nice
shout loud. I'm better received here.
Yeah.
You know, that's for sure. In the United States, I'm not... I will say, I manage my way, you know, wherever I speak. Yeah, last week I was speaking in Memphis, Tennessee.
I know from the song.
Right. I still have 250 people wherever I go. So I managed, but I'll tell you, it was hard.
Yeah, I suppose
it
so.
Was hard.
Yeah.
You know, I had. I won't say I had to fight. I would have to say I was very persistent, because I will not sell out. I mean, I always say whenever I'm on, you give me right now. Make an offer, $1 million, to change one comma in the Holocaust industry. Put it down here, $1 million. I'm not going to do it. I know it. People look at me like I'm crazy. I'm not doing it. Of course, if an editor asks me to change it, I'll change, because it's an intellectual criterion. But for money, I'm not selling periods, I'm not selling commas, I'm not selling anything. It's just, I'm not doing it. That's me. You know, it may sound like an empty boast. Anyone who knows me knows it's true. You cannot buy me. Okay, $1 billion.
All right, that says it all. I think we've got to wrap it up here. Right. Thank you, Norma Finkelstein, the author of the least... non-controversial book of the most highly non-controversial book of this week at this book fair. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.